2012, February 13th. Today is Astronomy 141, Lecture 27. Is there life on Mars? All right. Well, today, we're going to talk about the topic of, is there life on Mars? And our mascot here is imposing himself between this and a beautiful picture from the Opportunity rover. This is a long-standing question. We talked last time about the conditions on the planet Mars, and we found that Mars is a dry, cold desert today. But was that always the case, either today or certainly in the past? Maybe Mars was a little bit wetter and warmer. If there's liquid water, there's a good chance that life could have arisen. We know that on the Earth, life arose within a few hundred million years of the stabilization of the Earth's climate with the appearance of the first oceans at the end of the Hadean and beginning of the Archean period. So if, in fact, Mars went through a significant period where it was warmer and there was liquid water on the surface, the conditions may have been ripe for the appearance of life, although maybe not intelligent life. Who knows? So today we're going to be talking about the search for life on Mars, not just speculation about what it might be, no real Martians yet, but the idea of Mars possibly being habitable springs from a lot of telescopic observations. They start back in the 18th and 19th centuries and into the 20th century. So this idea that Mars might be inhabitable, especially even by intelligent life, is really deeply rooted in our popular culture. The first space probes that went there, however, pretty much disproved one of the things that came out of these observations, the idea that there were Martian canals. I remember growing up still reading in even reputable science books about the canals and possible vegetation. There were seasonal patterns that were seen to come and go on the planet. Turns out there were no, the seasonal patterns they were seeing were seasonal dust storms, but the telescopes from Earth were not good enough to show that. But once we actually got there with spacecraft, the spacecraft pretty much just wiped out all those ideas because Mars was a cold, dry desert. We saw a little bit of that last time. We'll talk a bit about, though, how we've responded to that knowledge by not completely writing off the red planet. There are possibilities for life, perhaps in its past, or having learned about extremophiles, things that can live under very, very extreme conditions on the Earth, the possibility that life could exist, microbiological, that's an analog to the extremophiles. The first attempt in the 1970s was with the Viking landers. It did actual biological experiments on Mars soil and basically found no conclusive evidence. There was a recent, back in the 90s, there was a big excitement about a Martian meteorite that landed on Earth many tens of thousands of years ago in Antarctica called Allen Hills 84001. There was a lot of controversy about whether or not that may have shown signs of fossil biological activity. And finally, a lot of the effort that we're putting now into literally billions of dollars of Mars exploration by robotic rovers, and probably will also be one of the foci if we ever send human beings to Mars in person, will be this search for life, either past or present. We want to talk a little bit about what the issues are in there, kind of bring in a lot of the main themes of this course and see how they're applied to whether there's life on the red planet. Well, this idea of Mars, especially intelligent life on Mars, is really deeply embedded in popular culture. War of the Worlds, we saw that at the beginning of the class in 1898, posited Martians that actually could come here and invade the Earth. But it's a common staple of science fiction. For example, Edgar Rice Burroughs of Tarzan fame wrote a whole series of novels set on Mars. It always seemed to be, you know, muscular men and winsome princesses always seemed to be one of those themes that Edgar Rice Burroughs seemed to have liked quite a bit. It's actually going to recur courtesy of Disney in a couple weeks here. That's not an ad. They're not paying me for it. Just a reminder, it's still in our consciousness. Of course, my favorite Martian is Marvin here, and first appeared in Looney Tunes cartoons in 1948. This, and then there are classic science fiction novels, Ray Bradbury's The Martian Chronicles from the 1950s, and of course, Stranger in a Strange Land, or very famous science fiction. I imagine most of you, if you're interested, have read these. The idea that Mars could be inhabitable, that it's another planet in our solar system that not only gave rise to life, but gave rise to intelligent life, is very old. It's very deeply embedded. And it has its basic origins in observations which were very difficult to interpret from the ground. It didn't just, well, a lot of this does, well, okay, some of this pops right out of your imagination. It wasn't a completely crazy thought for a long time. The first good telescopic observations, really good telescopic observations, in the late 18th and early 19th centuries showed that Mars had terrain, or at least it had dark and light spots. It revealed the presence of the poles. You could see the Martian northern and southern poles grow and shrink as they went through the Martian seasons. Even William Herschel, working in the 18th century, discovered the tilt of Mars and the seasonal variations on Mars, at least watching the poles grow and recede. And from that concluded the possibility that Mars would have a climate. Very much, they thought, like our own. They had no way to measure how heavy the atmosphere was or not. And so they pretty much allowed themselves to speculate. Mars was showing itself to be a place with weather, with seasons. And from that, they reasoned the possibility that Mars may, in fact, also harbor life. But they didn't really fully understand how to make that assessment. One of the real mainstays, though, of this idea of Mars harboring intelligent life goes back to the first real mapping of Mars. You have to go to really good telescopes. You have to wait for just those moments when the atmosphere just settles down for a moment. And you can see super clear before the turbulence takes over again. Looking out through our atmosphere is analogous to lying on the bottom of a swimming pool looking up. Everything looks distorted, passing through all the thermal turbulence in our Earth's atmosphere. We still have to apply technologies to do better until we could go into space. But even so, it was quite remarkable what people could do just with the human eye and a very, very well-designed telescope at a good site during those good conditions. And one of the real pioneers was an Italian astronomer by the name of Giovanni Schiaparelli. He worked at the Milan Observatory in the late 1870s, and he began to see linear features in the Martian map. Now, this is his map of Mars. You can see that none of these linear features are perfectly straight lines. What he was seeing were the dark and light regions that we've already seen in modern pictures of the Martian terrain. Mars has a lot of dark regions and light regions. It has highlands and lowlands. Through the telescope, he was seeing these only blurry, and of course, as Mars rotates and you watch it night after night, you can slowly build up a map. So, Schiaparelli, of course, is working in Italian. He talks about these long sort of linear features which were sort of channel-like, and he used the word canali. Oops, that was a problem. Because canali, which means just a linear thing, got turned into canal. That's where our word canal, which was a purpose-built linear ditch to carry water for transport. So people, this idea of canali channels, which is what he was really thinking was geological channels, got translated into canal, which is a purpose-built water transportation system. Now, he thought of them, and he wrote very explicitly that these were natural features, that there was weather on the planet, that there were natural flows, and that what you were seeing were these flow channels. But that wasn't always what people heard. And in particular, it was the American astronomer Percival Lowell, who lived at the end of the 19th and beginning of the 20th century, who took Schiaparelli's canali as literally canals, and decided to try to investigate them because they met with his notions of the possibility of life on Mars. Lowell was a scion of the famous Lowells of Boston, who were among the most wealthy families. In fact, Lowell, Massachusetts is named after them, the big mill town. And Lowell was independently wealthy. He was not quite the Bill Gates of his day, but he was definitely high in the fraction of 1% of the time, to use the current argot. And he was a little bit different for his family. He suffered from health problems. He decided to head out west, as many people did at that time, to try to address their health questions. Living in Boston with its soot and bad air conditions and terribly cold winters typically did not appeal to people, and often going to the west, and he ended up making his way to Flagstaff, Arizona. Now, Flagstaff, Arizona also has really brutally cold winters, but has beautiful clear skies, and it really is dry most of the year. And he decided to buy a piece of land outside of Flagstaff, which he renamed the site Mars Hill, and built an observatory on top of that site. And he used his own personal money to build this. This guy was pretty well loaded. And he built himself up to finally getting a fairly hefty refracting telescope. Here's a photograph of Lowell at the end of his life at the backside of the telescope. And he spent 20 years observing Mars visually, no photography at all, mapping out the planet. And he firmly believed that the features that he saw were in fact strongly linear features, that they were purpose-built canal systems, and to him was absolute proof that Mars was inhabited, if not now, at least in the recent past, by highly intelligent beings. They were living on a desert world that was dying, and these canals were being used to transport water from the poles down to the equatorial regions to keep their way of life going. That's quite a stretch to go from a series of observations of vaguely linear features that would come or go just during those instances when the air quality is just perfect, when the air is just still, to see and back off. And he made detailed maps. OSU used to be a partner in the Lowell Observatory. We operated jointly a 72-inch telescope that used to be up in Delaware, Ohio for many years. And in the museum there are Lowell's original maps. This is actually a photograph from my collection of those. Beautiful map, very detailed, put names on the features. He saw all kinds of double canals. He named the various terrains. He did a relatively active imagination. And people really took this seriously. He gave a lot of popular lectures, and all the way to his death, he believed that these things were real. The problem was nobody else saw them, or nobody else could really see them. Now, admittedly, this is early 20th century. This is before the time when people realized that the western United States, especially the Southwest, had unusually good seeing conditions. We now think of the West as the site of the great observatories. Kitt Peak, Mount Graham, Mount Palomar, Mount Wilson, Lick Observatory on Mount Hamilton were all built to take advantage of the West's long periods of clear weather, the nice flows of air that make the air very steady above it. Before, they would have their telescopes in places like Chicago, Boston, Delaware, Ohio, not known for their great seeing. So people had a hard time once to actually be able to reproduce this because they didn't have good enough sight. So they kind of had to take what he was saying at face value, but they didn't believe it. We now know that what he saw was, in fact, an optical illusion. Okay, but we'll get into that in a second. So this idea of canals, straight-line features, possibly water-carrying channels, maybe natural, maybe purpose-built, although most people thought probably natural because they didn't really want to take that leap to purpose-built, therefore purposeful intelligence building them, stuck for a long time. I remember as a young kid following the space agency, there were serious science books that still talked about the canals, talked about vegetation possibly on Mars. These were serious scientific books. When the first spacecraft went by, Mariner 4 in 1965, and the first orbiter, Mariner 9, in 1971, this is where my real recollection comes in there. I was 10, 11 years old when that went through. Showed that Mars basically was a completely dry desert world. The view of Mars, heavily cratered terrain, there were channels, but they're old and ancient geology. This is past, not present. The canal features, the long linear features seen by both Schiaparelli, and more precisely those mapped out by Lowell, were seen to be optical illusions. They basically didn't exist. And the reason why they didn't exist is basically people have realized for years, what was it that made these things appear? And the answer turned out to be you're viewing the back of your eye. This may seem really strange, but try this sometime. Don't do this with the sun, please. You'll put your eye out. Do it with a bright light bulb. Stare at a bright light bulb for a second and then close your eye and turn away. You see the patterning of veins on the back of your eye for just a second. If you put a very, very bright light like Venus or Mars or something like that in a really big telescope on the back of your eye, you dazzle the back of your eye, and in those seconds what you see is the patterning of veins on the back of your eye. And that was being superimposed upon Mars. And Lowell was simply staring intently for long periods of time. And so it's very likely what he was mapping was not the canals on Mars, but the vein pattern on the back of his eye. But it happens. And then if you couple that with a brain that wants to see something, there you go. However, this idea that Mars could have weather, could have liquid water, could have vegetation, persisted in the serious scientific literature right up to the 1970s. Why? This wasn't fanciful science fiction. These weren't people making things up. They were using the best knowledge they could. Why did it persist all the way pretty much until Mariner 9 pretty much put paid to it in 1972? That's 72. That's just a... Okay, for some of you, that's ancient history. For me, that's when I was a kid. The reason goes to this diagram. This is a colorful version of the diagram that's in your problem number 3. What happened is that measurements of the atmosphere before the spacecraft were sent are very, very difficult, right? We try to use spectroscopy. We try to assay how much of an atmosphere does Mars have, how much carbon dioxide there is. One of the first sets of real good observations of the planet Mars spectroscopically, taken in the mid-20th century, the 1950s, showed pretty clearly that Mars had a mostly carbon dioxide atmosphere with just bare traces of water vapor. But it was primarily a carbon dioxide-rich atmosphere, which is what we in fact know it is today. They tried to measure the amount of carbon dioxide, because the amount of carbon dioxide would give you the total mass of the atmosphere. And remember, what makes surface pressure in an atmosphere is the total weight of the atmosphere above you crushing down into gravity. And what happens is, from those measurements, they're so difficult that they actually overestimated the weight of Mars's atmosphere. They thought Mars had a more substantial atmosphere than it did. What does that do? It raises the surface pressure of Mars. Now, why does that matter? This is a phase diagram for water. On the horizontal axis, we plot the temperature. And on the vertical axis, we plot the pressure. And the pressure here is in that wonderful unit of the Pascal. In round numbers, one Earth atmosphere is 100,000 pascals, 0.1 megapascals, to use your homework units. And water goes through three phases. It can be a solid, an ice, a liquid, or a vapor. Now, we often talk about what is the temperature at which water solidifies, or the temperature at which water boils. You'll notice I always have qualified that with at standard temperature and pressure, or at the surface of the Earth. This blue line shows one Earth atmosphere. Now, we can't really change the pressure of the Earth's atmosphere unless we open up the pressure vessel. So we're talking about standing water on the surface of the Earth. If the temperature is below 273 degrees Kelvin, it goes into the solid phase. If it's between 273 and 300 degrees Kelvin, it's in the liquid phase. Above about 300 degrees Kelvin, which is the boiling, not 300 degrees Kelvin, 373 degrees Kelvin, thank you. So 273 to 373 Kelvin, 373 degrees Kelvin is 100 Celsius, water boils. And at all temperatures higher than that, you have very high temperature steam. So same pressure. All I can do is I can vary the temperature back and forth. So liquid water is stable over 100 degrees Celsius on the Earth. Take away half the Earth's atmosphere, I will pretty much freeze at the same place, 273, but I will boil at a lower temperature, about, in this case, 340 degrees Celsius here, and down here, I'll boil at an even lower temperature. So the range of stability for liquid water is smaller. If I make the Earth's atmosphere higher pressure, I can increase the range where water can actually be liquid up to almost 500 degrees Celsius. 500 degrees Celsius, I would have to make the atmosphere very much heavier, like 50, 60 times heavier than it is now. Venus has a very heavy atmosphere, and your problem asks you to look at the consequences of what's the phase of water. And you find, in fact, that water's vapor. There's no stable form of water on Venus. Well, what about Mars? Well, the original pre-spacecraft estimates based on ground-based spectroscopy of Mars, they had to go to the highest possible mountains because there's a problem. We're looking through the Earth's atmosphere, but the Earth's atmosphere contains carbon dioxide. You're looking for the spectral signature of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere of Mars. So how do you distinguish terrestrial carbon dioxide from Mars carbon dioxide? It's tough. Ideally, you do it by getting above the atmosphere. Kind of hard to do before you invent the ability to go to orbit. So you had to do the best you could. You went to the highest mountains. So for example, you went to the top of high mountains in Colorado. There was one experiment that actually went to the top of Mount Whitney in California, the highest mountain in the continental U.S. Well, lower 48. And tried to do the observations, and they were really difficult. And the bracketed range were these red dotted lines in the pre-spacecraft world. So the pressure was pretty low. You know, this one interval here on this graph, that's less than a tenth. So this is maybe 1/30th, 1/40th the atmospheric pressure at the surface of the Earth, which gave you a very restricted range of temperature. Basically, water was stable between 273 and about 320 degrees Celsius. Or down here, even down to 300 Celsius. So a little tiny narrow range, but still a narrow range of temperatures in which water could be liquid. So if you could just get solar heating just enough, you could get standing water on the surface of Mars. That's what they thought. So the fact that the atmospheric conditions of pressure and temperature seem to allow, even if very narrow, a region for possible liquid water gave people the idea that you could have standard state flows. And if you had water, you could have life. You could support plant life, microbiological life. And then the spacecraft went to Mars. They're free of all the constraints of doing this from the ground. And what they found? They way overestimated the pressure. The pressure is actually really small. The basic number is given in your notes. It's basically 0.007 atmospheres, 7,000ths of the Earth's atmosphere. And when you do that, you're right down here on the tip. You're near the so-called triple point in the phase diagram. And now, if you're at that low pressure, which was measured by the Mariner 6 and Mariner 7 spacecraft in 1969, and subsequently confirmed by all subsequent landers and everything else, you're in a regime where you go straight from ice right into vapor. You never pass liquid, you don't pass go, you don't collect liquid water. The process of going from solid to vapor phase is called sublimation. It's what dry ice does. If you drew the phase diagram for carbon dioxide, you would find at normal atmospheric conditions on the Earth, carbon dioxide goes straight from solid phase to gas. That's why it's called dry ice. You don't get a puddle of liquid carbon dioxide in between. So water ice acts like dry ice at low pressures. And on the pressures of Mars, the range is exceedingly small. So small that it is essentially water is not stable on the surface. And that was the big insight that suddenly made people stop talking about liquid water flows in the present, stable water on the surface. And it's why people talk about it as being stable water in the past. Because remember, we talked about last time, Mars lost a lot of its atmosphere over its history. Its gravity's small, it's hard to hang on to that atmosphere. When it solidified in the interior and lost its magnetic field, the solar wind stripped off that atmosphere. As you take off the atmosphere, you have less weight above you, your surface air pressure drops. And so while Mars now is in this part of the diagram, in the past, a heavier atmosphere, still carbon dioxide, will only move you up in the phase diagram into a place where liquid water is stable. So this is one of the reasons we talk about the possibility of liquid water being present on Mars in the past. Now, the other problem is the surface temperature is over here in the solid ice phase. So what one hopes is if you have enough carbon dioxide and water vapor in the atmosphere, you can get a greenhouse effect and drive the equilibrium temperature maybe into the narrow zone where liquid water is present. So we don't think about Mars as being wet now. It is a case where water, even if I dumped, I could bring as much liquid water as I wanted to the planet. I could fill the craters with it. It would simply either freeze solid or flash into a vapor. It wouldn't exist as stable standing liquid water. And that's the fundamental issue with the habitability of Mars today. Any questions about that? Because that was kind of a long time on one slide, but it's fairly important to this. So back to it. What were the canals? The canals were optical illusions. The human visual system is very good at picking out patterns even when those patterns are not there. The canals is just one example. Once you got spacecraft to the planet, the canals were gone, so people stopped talking about canals. Of course, the spacecraft images gave them a whole bunch of other things to talk about. My favorite is the face on Mars. This is basically from the Viking orbiter. Remember, the Vikings I mentioned last time were a double spacecraft. There were two of them. Each consisted of a spacecraft bus, which was left in orbit, and then the lander detached from it and went to the ground, landing softly and working successfully. The landers stayed in orbit but carried cameras, actually, for their time, pretty high-definition video cameras, and took pictures of the surface. Now, this is a raw image, so all the little dots you see here are bad pixels. This is not, nothing's been processed here. This is the raw data. And down on one of the planes, there was this little feature of this little butte that, wow, you grab that and you can see a face in that. Yep. And I saw a face in the front grill of a Dodge sitting in my neighborhood when the snow fell on it just right. It looked like the Dodge had a pair of eyebrows on top of its headlights. The human visual system is very good at matching faces. This is probably evolutionary, so babies can recognize human faces. Ooh, mom, I should be cooing. Oh, tiger, I should run like hell. so we're very good at picking faces out of crowds, even though we shouldn't be able to do it. It's just how our visual system works. Of course, this is kind of a crappy image. So here's a much better image from 2007 with a very high-definition camera. And, it's just a mountain, a little butte sitting in the middle of this plain. I still get email from the Mars face crazies. They find my podcast, they find my lectures, and they feel they need to educate me for 500 megabytes worth of stuff on the Mars phase. And there's lots of other things. People see pyramids, they see all kinds of things. And there are. There's lots of things on Mars. First of all, Galle Crater is a very happy place. And since it's nearly close to Valentine's Day, it's nice to know that Mars loves you. This is just a double crater that looks like a heart. It was found in the Mars Orbiter camera. But none of this is signs of intelligence. None of this stuff is purpose-built. It just kind of looks that way if you look at it just right. All right. That gets rid of those things. What about life on Mars? Now, obviously, it'd be kind of nice to have intelligent life on Mars, I suppose. Certainly interesting to have someone to talk to. But the conditions are not ripe. We do not see any evidence of any artifacts on the surface present of past intelligent life. If we look at the Mars history that we've been able to reconstruct, and we saw a little bit of that reconstruction on Friday, Mars was really only warm and wet for maybe less than the first billion years or so of its history, and then it very rapidly dried out. Basically, Mars was not a stable planet in terms of maintaining a warm, dense atmosphere. It geologically went cold. Magnetic field shut down, lost its atmosphere, it's far enough away from the sun. All the water that was in the atmosphere simply froze out below the surface, and the planet basically dried out and froze. Evolution needs time to act, and a billion years just seems to be way too short. After all, to get to us took 3.5 billion years. But if you look at the Earth's history, in the early first billion years, few hundred million years of life on our planet, it was microbiological. In fact, the first 2 billion years or so of life on this planet was single-celled organisms. So while Mars probably never had a sustained environment that could lead to the evolution of large, multicellular, intelligent creatures, there's no reason to suspect it wasn't warm and liquid enough, maybe, to have actually led to microbiological life, single-celled organisms. And so the question is, A, have any of those survived to the present day? Because we know of subsurface organisms on our own planet that can survive under conditions of unusual heat, unusual cold, unusual dryness, but not bone dry, and so forth, extremophiles. So there's some thought that maybe the life can exist just below the surface. Subsurface life is shielded from ultraviolet radiation. There's certainly an expectation of a lot of subsurface water vapor. It had to go somewhere, and it probably froze below the surface. And as we saw last Friday, the proton experiments flown on the Mars orbiter, in fact, found a lot of subsurface water ice on the planet. We don't know how far subsurface, but probably not too far subsurface. So the idea was to start the process of looking for organic metabolic processes on the planet. The first major attempt of this was the Viking landers, Viking 1 and Viking 2, Launched in 1975, landed in 1976, the first of them on July 4th, 1976, right in time for the U.S. bicentennial, and carried on board a scoop to dig up Martian subsurface soil and dump it into a series of experiments that would chemically analyze that. Now, we're not going to go into a lot of detail. I'll just mention what they are. They would feed the sample of soil carbon-rich nutrient material, which is tagged with radioactive carbon, and see if, in fact, there was any uptake, assimilation of that carbon, like might be with a metabolic process. Living things on Earth take up carbon and use that carbon to make food. There's gas exchange. Biological systems on Earth breathe in carbon dioxide, breathe out oxygen. So we do gas exchange as nutrient waste. You can do what's called label release. Bring in materials radioactively labeled and look for the release of that material as a waste product. Or use a mass spectrograph. The mass spectrograph would chemically break down the stuff and look for complex organic compounds. They would have very specific mass spectrograph signatures. You're looking for big molecules made of carbon. The first three of these experiments, carbon assimilation, gas phase, and label release, is basically looking for carbon metabolism. Right, you're either taking the stuff up as a nutrient, or you're spewing it back out as a waste, or you're converting it into something, and you see that chemical change within the sample. You assay it before, you dump on the nutrient, you assay it after, and you look for the products of chemical reactions similar to carbon metabolism. The last experiment was simply a pure assay detection experiment. So that's really what they're doing is, remember, qualification of life. You make utilization of energy, utilize nutrients, have a metabolism. So that's what they were looking for. It's a very basic metabolic experiment. The results were actually conflicting. It was not a solid no, nor was it a solid yes. Although people are slowly but surely leaning on the side of pretty darn good no. The carbon assimilation and gas exchange gave positives. They actually saw uptake of carbon. But the problem is there are inorganic processes that can happen to do this. In particular, the soil samples they picked up had a very large content of iron peroxide. Iron peroxide can lead to is a strong oxidant. And so when you introduce the carbon nutrient material, you oxidized it in the presence of the iron peroxide. So one possibility is that the fact what you're seeing is an abiotic chemistry going on. That's always the risk in this. There's lots of other possibilities. The radioactive labeled release was pretty good. It actually gave a burst of oxygen when the soil was wetted. But when then you wetted the soil with a bit of nutrient, nothing happened. Didn't do a thing. Excuse me. So this burst of oxygen, again, in the presence of strong oxidants, you could have simply released the oxygen from those embedded oxidizing salts. I would say that the general feeling of most scientists from the examination of the Viking data, and there are better ways to do the experiments that people are designing now, is the problem was the unexpectedly high presence of oxidants basically really sort of monkey wrenched the original experiment. The idea they kind of had in mind was like going up to the dry Atacama Desert, where we do see, in fact, you know, soil sterile down to almost a meter depth in some places. But you can kind of revive it if you dig down below that sterile layer, dump water on it, all of a sudden you get a lot of microbiological activity. But that was, they didn't reckon on a lot of the oxidization component. So that may be part of what's going on. So much more sophisticated experiments, which didn't make such, in retrospect, fairly simplifying assumptions come into play. That's why the results are very conflicting. The spectrograph, the thing that actually did the detailed chemical assay of the Martian soil, found no organic molecules down to extremely low levels. Again, if I go to the most sterile soils on the Earth, in like the dry Atacama or some of the high Antarctic valleys, the driest places I can find, I can find organic molecules throughout that material. But the relationship of that material found on the driest, supposedly sterilest places on Earth were 10 million times more organics than were found in the Mars soil samples. Now, the labeled release stuff, which is the burst of oxygen, people still argue about, but no one doubts that this carbon assimilation and gas exchange were due to simply the presence of the strong oxidization. In short, there's an awful lot of words up here. The results from the Mars lander were very conflicting, but it seems to be coming down on no active life on the planet now, but there's enough loopholes left that we really haven't exhausted the ways in which you can make the measurement. And so that's where people are now aiming the next generation of more sophisticated experiments. One hopes that our robotic technology has gotten better since 1976. Our computers certainly have, and everything else has as well. So we can expect in the future Mars biological laboratories are going to be able to make much more controlled, much more sophisticated experiments to address this. We don't have a firm answer. Kind of seems like no, but there's some openings. The other opening for Mars life emerged with the discovery of this rock called Allen Hills 001, found in 1984. The best place to find meteors on the Earth is the Antarctic, because they sit as black rocks sitting right out on top of the Antarctic ice. It's really easy to find a rock sitting on the ice. It's a little harder to find a rock when it's mixed in with other Earth rocks. It kind of has to stand out, like it has to hit your car, like the Peekskill meteor took out the back end of a Chevy Malibu back in the 1980s. It happens every now and then. A meteor's going to hit you, it's going to land on something, hit a dog in North Africa. Sometimes they do, fairly spectacular things, and you know where to go looking. But routine meteors, most of the meteors that we study come from the Antarctic ice. And a lot of geologists go out, people who study meteors, that's what they do. They go out into certain nice fields where there's relatively pristine ice, and they go pick up the rocks, and they look for the meteors that fall out there. It's a great place. The other thing that can happen is, of course, the ice flows carry meteors that have been hitting there for thousands of years, and eventually they pop up on the surface due to the ice flows. So you not only find the new meteors that fell in the last year, but you can actually go back 10, 20, 30,000 years worth of meteor fall. One of these found in the Allen Hills region of Antarctica in 84 is this big chunk of rock right here, the first one they found that year. It's kind of an odd piece of rock. When it got analyzed, what they found is that the mix of gases locked up inside, because they're old pockets, would carry gases from where it was solidified, had the mix of gases that are seen on Mars from the Mars landers. Furthermore, the radioactive age dating put it about 4.5 billion years old. There's a very, very rare class of meteorites which actually have their origins on the surface of Mars. Very large asteroidal impacts dig craters. Some of those rocks that are knocked off the surface of the planet actually escape its gravity and go out into orbiting around the sun. And a few of them have crossed paths with the Earth. There's a very small number of these. They're exceedingly rare. And the most valuable meteors on the Earth are the ones that originated. They're actual pieces of Mars. So we didn't have to quite spend billions of dollars bring a sample return mission. We can just kind of wait for the occasional bit of Mars debris to hit us. Of course, we don't get to pick what we bring back, so that's why we're still doing the Mars sample returns. When people realized that Allen Hills was one of the largest of the Mars asteroids that's ever been found, they began to immediately begin to analyze it. Here's a rare opportunity to see a piece of the surface of another planet. What was very interesting about the Allen Hills meteor is a lot of the minerals inside of it showed formation in the presence of liquid water, and they showed in particular carbonate crystals, which again is a sign of a water precipitate, in this case a water precipitate which includes carbonaceous, carbon-bearing material, presence of carbon dioxide dissolved into the water. Now this is all in 1984 in the early 80s before you really got into the really recent experiments that could look for subsurface ice and the new generation of landers that were looking specifically for subsurface ice. Viking did not find subsurface ice. It didn't dig down deep enough, perhaps. So this was another piece, the first really hard geological evidence of minerals from Mars that formed in the presence of liquid water. In 1996, however, microscopic analysis of the mineralogy of this led a group of authors to claim that they found not only hydrated minerals, but they also found fossil remnants of microbiological life inside this rock. It led to a statement by then President Clinton about, you know, life possibly being found in other worlds. It became a mainstay of science fiction ever since. Here's the evidence they presented. There were three basic lines of evidence that were presented for the possibility of biological activity present in this ancient Allen Hills meteor. So the idea is this is a rock which originated from when Mars, early in its history, was warm and wet. And therefore, that's the time when you expect there to be life. The first thing they found were these sort of carbon chicken wire molecules called polycyclic aromatic hydrocarbons, and they also found amino acids. That's not really hard evidence for life because we find polycyclic aromatic hydrocarbons and amino acids in meteors that have nothing to do with Mars. Meteors that formed out of the raw debris of the solar system. And in fact, we find amino acids and these PAHs, polycyclic aromatic hydrocarbons, in interstellar space. So it shows that the rock was rich in organics, was from an environment rich in organics, but you can plausibly say that, yeah, we've seen there, been there, done that. They're made all over the place. So that's not hard evidence. The other thing they found was microscopic crystals of a compound called magnetite. Magnetite's found both in naturally occurring systems. It can also be aggregated by certain types of bacteria. There are actually organs in certain birds and other creatures that are magnetically sensitive, and they're basically made of magnetites. And there are certain bacteria that can aggregate magnetite within them, and they form them into crystal structures that do not normally, not always, but normally form abiotically. So they tried to find a very close analog between these structures found in the Allen Hills meteorite and these similar beads of magnetite crystals found. This top one is from a terrestrial bacteria. So again, they were drawing this by analogy of structures. We see these structures in terrestrial bacteria. Here's the magnetite left over because these are obviously mineral crystals embedded within the bacterium. The bacteria that surrounded it is long, or whatever it was, is long since gone, and it's left behind this bead of magnetite behind. It's kind of like finding the remnants of something, but not the thing itself. It's a tricky argument to make as to whether you want to buy it or not, but it certainly is suggestive. Although there are, as people have pointed out long since, there are abiological ways to make chains of magnetites. It's not hard. It's basic chemical precipitation. And you can do it. They were just arguing that because they're found in biological systems, this meant it came from a biological system. That's an interpretation, not the only one. So it's a controversial point, but it's, you know, people argue both sides of it, and they both have merit. It's really hard to sort out how to interpret it, because all you see is the remnants. The final piece are these little bits down here. This is an electron micrograph of a section of the Allen Hills meteor, which shows these little features here, which have shapes very strongly reminiscent of what are called on Earth nanobacteria. These are the smallest microbiological nanobacterial creatures we know of on our planet. We do see things that do get that we do see very, very tiny bacteria on our planet. They are capable of fossilization. But, again, you're drawing an analogy by shape. There's no evidence that these things contain organic compounds. They have organic function or life function. And furthermore, one little tiny detail that kind of got left out of the initial press releases but came out in subsequent analysis is, if they are nanobacteria, they are much, much smaller than any nanobacteria seen on Earth. And it's really hard to understand how they can be so small and still function. And so that's the main argument against the nanobacteria argument. So far, I would say, if I wanted to summarize what the evidence from the Allen Hills meteor is, yep, there were organics on Mars, there was liquid water, the formation of hydrated minerals and carbonate crystals. Cool, okay. That kind of goes along with this idea that Mars was warm and wet in the past. Is there evidence for life? It's all circumstantial, and it's readily argued that it's something else. That we're looking at are mineral analogous forms, not actual life. And I think that's pretty close to a consensus view. There are still people who dissent from that, who think this is strong evidence for life. But what's nice is, even though it's a dissent, it's a testable proposition. We can go back and find rocks from the right place by studying Mars geology. We know what rocks to bring back than what was simply accidentally knocked off the surface and fell to the Earth. And so a goal of future Mars sample return is to find rocks that might be more controlled and likely to be actually of possible harbors for fossil bacterial life or fossil single cell life of some kind. Now, a final argument about Allen Hills meteor, it's not a fresh fall. It's estimated to have been in the ice for more than 10,000 years. So the other possibility is some of this can be explained away as contamination. So one has to be extremely careful about how you handle samples and knowing their history. And again, getting it bare from Mars is an obvious way to control for contamination. It does mean your experimental protocols have got to be solid, because you don't want to contaminate it, because bacteria on Earth get on everything, including our spacecraft. So how do you sterilize the spacecraft? There's a lot of challenges in trying to get at this question. The other pieces of evidence for possible life, this came up a few years ago in 2004, was the detection of methane in the planet Mars, actually from ground-based telescopes on the Earth. This is one of the few places where a real advance in something changing on Mars came from the Earth rather than from an orbiting spacecraft, although now it's a subject of orbiting spacecraft. Methane is a big deal because methane in the inner solar system is primarily a biological byproduct, primarily, but not only. And the reason for that, why it's so exciting, is methane is unstable. If you have any oxygen around at all, even oxygen released from water vapor, which has been cracked open, methane plus oxygen forms water plus carbon dioxide. So if you released a whole bunch of methane, just poofed a bunch of methane out into the Martian atmosphere, so for example, from the guts of a large animal, makes a lot of methane, it's going to last 300 years before the methane breaks down in that environment. So you have to have a recent source. That's what the point is. This could not be methane left over from the origins of the solar system. It had to come within the last few hundred years. The problem is there's lots of different ways to get methane down recently. A fragment of a comet, maybe there is some volcanism. Maybe there's still a few hot spot vents, not major big, you know, repaving volcanism, but there still could be little vents and leakage points. A little bit of hot stuff still left in a few pockets can basically blow out a bit of methane. You unleash chemistry within methane locked up inside of rock. The other possibility, however, and this is what got people's attention, is the other source of methane generation is biological processes. There are a group of bacteria on the earth called methanogens, things that make methane. They turn out to be bacteria, they're photosynthetic, and they produce methane rather than oxygen as an output. The earliest, most primitive form of photosynthetic bacteria on the earth were methanogens. So the idea being is that when you see methane, it is a biological process compared to both exogenous processes, basically things coming from the outside, and volcanoes, things coming from inside the planet. So this one remains an open question. It's really interesting that methane appeared where it probably shouldn't be. It's going to take further examination. Finally, the last piece of evidence has come out. In 2008, the Mars Phoenix lander found water and perchlorate salts up near the North Pole. So it dug into the soil, but now we know we're in a place where there is lots of frozen water because you're near the pole. And sure enough, one of those high-resolution cameras, they dug a trench out, and you can see there's a whole bunch of stuff in here that over here has pretty well begun to vanish. It's changed shape. See, there's a particular little bit that I was going to grab. This particular bit of here, you'll notice, is gone over here. So it's a combination of carbon dioxide and water ice. When exposed to sunlight, the water ice is simply sublimated away into a gas. Also, during the course of its existence, it suddenly became too cold. It only lasted one season and it got so cold its electronics froze and Phoenix went dark. But it actually saw water snow falling from light clouds in the polar regions. So it saw the precipitation, the accumulation of new snow. It saw the liquid water cycling. More importantly, it found calcium carbonate in the cycle, in the soil. Calcium carbonate is a precipitate of carbon dioxide dissolved in liquid water. So some of the minerals up here were formed in the presence of liquid water, not the unstable ice flash to gas that's now seen in the current low-pressure environment. They also found lots and lots of perchlorate salts. And this, again, is part of the piece that we saw with trying to understand the Viking results, was the presence of the perchlorate salts. So again, lots of interesting stuff going on. Perchlorate salts are important because they lower the freezing point of water. They change where you are in that phase diagram. So standing pure water might not exist, but standing salty water could. Maybe not on the surface, but below the surface. So the question of life on Mars is still a big open question. We're going to keep going back. This is Curiosity, launched in December. We'll arrive in August this year to do a full assay. It's one of a number of craft which we're sending to the Red Planet to keep up the search for life. The answer, is there life on Mars? We don't know, but we're still going to keep looking. Any questions? Good. I'll see you all tomorrow then.